Let's dive straight into spillover. You spent 5 years following scientists into bat caves, African forests, Chinese markets. What was the most eye-catching moment for you during that journey? And did you ever realize we were going to head towards a global pandemic a few years later?
I'll take the second question first. The answer to that is yes. Near the end of my research, I started asking these scientists, look, is there going to be a next big one, next big pandemic? And if so, what does it look like? And the consensus of what they told me was, yes, there is a big one coming. And this is conversations that we were having in like 2009, 2010. Spillover was published in 2012. So these scientists, including a wonderful infectious disease scientist named Don Burke, who at that point was dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine and was a longtime emerging disease expert. They told me, yes, there is a next big one coming. It will be caused by a virus, a zoonotic virus, meaning one coming out of a wild animal and getting into humans, as most of our infectious diseases do. What kind of a virus? A single-stranded RNA virus, a virus with a genome that evolves quickly. And the RNA viruses evolve much more quickly than the DNA viruses. Some families of viruses have RNA genomes, some have DNA genomes. The RNA viruses evolve much more quickly. I can talk about why that is. But the point is that these scientists knew it would be an RNA virus. And in particular, probably coming from one of the families that have a history of passing from wild animals into humans, such as the influenzas, the measles virus family, and the coronaviruses. What sort of an animal might this come out of? Well, maybe a rodent, maybe a bat, maybe something else. Where might that happen? Oh, well, in a wet market in China, for instance. So they told me that, and I printed that in Spillover in 2012.
And was it always on the back of your mind after printing it in 2012? Did you always think it's on its way, or did you kind of forget about it? And then 2019/20 comes and you're like, oh, the prediction was right.
I did not forget about it. I remained acutely aware of it. People asked me to write op-eds about this. But when I published Spillover in 2012 for the US edition, it was a little bit later than that, maybe a year or two later in the UK and in Italy, and it's been very well received in Italy, especially after COVID. But when I published it, it was well reviewed. It did okay. But people sort of said, oh, viruses that come out of wild animals, well, there's Quammen banging on again about something obscure. And isn't that quaint and interesting and something out on the fringe of medical science and the fringe of probability? That was the way it was thought of. But I don't want to overestimate the skepticism that met it, but it was not greeted as something that was urgently probable. And then when COVID began, December of 2019, January of 2020, I could see, as other people, minority of people could see, immediately that this was likely to be the next big one. I got an email on January 13th of 2020 alerting me and others to the fact that the new virus that was causing some interest and some concern in Wuhan, China, was a coronavirus. And as soon as I saw the word coronavirus, I thought, okay, this could be it. That was January 13th, 2020. The New York Times contacted me then because I write occasional op-eds for them. And this op-ed editor for the New York Times said to me, hey, Quammen, it's been a while since you did an op-ed for us. Why don't you do another one on anything that you might think was important and interesting? oh, even, for instance, this virus in Wuhan, China? And I said immediately, yes, indeed. I want to write an op-ed about this virus in Wuhan, China, because this could be the next big one. So I wrote an op-ed to that effect for the New York Times. It ran on January 28th of 2020, which was still early, not early for the scientists, but it was early for the public to be told that this could be a pandemic virus. And then I got on a plane for Tasmania because I was researching a book on cancer as an evolutionary phenomenon, including genuinely contagious cancer in the Tasmanian devil. We can talk about that a little bit if you want, because I've just finished that book a week ago, finally. So I went to Tasmania, and I was there for all of February of 2020 and a little bit of March. And I was following Tasmanian devil biologists around in the bush. But when I went back to my hotel, I would have these messages saying, can you talk on Russian television? Can you talk to CNN? Can you talk to the Wall Street Journal? Can you talk to this podcast or that podcast? How did you know this? Or why do you think that this virus is going to be the next pandemic? And how did you know that it might be? So I spent half my time at the Australian Broadcasting Corporation studios in Hobart, Tasmania. Not half my time, but considerable time, talking to people in February around the world about why I knew this might be the next pandemic. And the reason I knew it might be the next pandemic is because I'd been paying attention to the scientific experts that I know.
In January and February 2020, what was your, if you had one, your prediction of the impact of the pandemic? Did you think we were going to go into basically a global lockdown and it was going to last so long? What were your predictions?
Well, one of the things about RNA viruses, novel RNA viruses coming into humans, whether it's a coronavirus or an influenza virus or what, is an inherently high degree of unpredictability. So the important thing to be known about them one of the important things is to understand the high degree of randomness, of sheer chance, of probabilities. The probabilities are broad. So I could not say, I think this is going to kill 7 million people and that we're going to have lockdowns. No, I couldn't predict anything like that. Here's the way I think of it, Jacob. With an influenza virus or a coronavirus, it's like you have a truck loaded with barrels of beer on the top of a hill, and with the emergency brake and set, and no one is in it. And suddenly the brake gives way, and this beer truck, without a driver, starts to roll down a hill on a road. And the road is covered with rocks and bumps and things like that. And it's going to roll down that hill. And on one side of the bottom, there's a big empty field with grass. And on the other side, there's a school with children in the playground, totally oblivious. And the truck is going to roll down, and it's somewhere it's going to hit a little rock that's going to turn it in one direction or the other. And you can't predict that in advance. You just can say there is a chance that if that truck is bumped a little bit to the left, it's going to plow into that playground and kill those children. If it gets bumped to the right, it's going to go into that grassy field. That's the way it is with RNA viruses.
And did you think that governments and countries were more prepared for a pandemic than they actually were? Did you doubt them to begin with?
Yes, I did. I did think that. I was surprised at how unprepared we were. That was the thing that surprised me more than anything. I was surprised that the public health officials and the political leadership in my country, in your country, in Italy, in a lot of countries, were not better prepared to deal with what was happening. For instance, when I flew back from Tasmania, Australia, it was probably March 3rd or March 4th of 2020, I expected airport screening. I expected high-tech airport screening because I had been told by scientists, you know, 10 years earlier about the development of high-tech airport screening so that in the time it takes to go through airport security, you could swab a person and stick the swab in some sort of a portable reader, and you could know that they were or were not infected with this new virus. And it wasn't there. Wasn't there. And nobody was wearing masks in the airports. Nobody was doing anything differently. And that surprised me. And maybe at that point, masks and airport screening might not have even helped. Maybe it was already too late, March 3rd, March 4th. The virus had gotten around. But it did surprise me that we weren't better prepared. But what the other thing that surprised me was how quickly we got good vaccines. Had we had good vaccines going into arms of the general public by November, the mRNA vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, and the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, and some Chinese vaccines that had value apparently, were developed very quickly, particularly using the mRNA technology. And that was the only pleasant surprise, the only relief surprise during that whole year.
How was it developed so quickly?
Well, I write about this in my book, Breathless. This one. And other people have written about it. But I tell the story of how there were a group of scientists in the U.S., led by a wonderful scientist named Barney Graham at the Vaccine Research Center, and some colleagues, some younger colleagues, and they had been working on mRNA vaccine technology focused on other viruses, focused on, for instance, the MERS virus, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome virus, among others. And respiratory syncytial virus. So they had been working on the concept of mRNA vaccines for years beforehand. And Barney Graham heard that this was a coronavirus, and he said to Tony Fauci, "You get me the genome of this virus and we'll start work right away." He said this to Tony Fauci early, very early on, probably in January. Certainly it was in January. And so they were waiting for the genome of this virus. And as soon as they had the genome, they started work on adapting their mRNA prototype vaccine technology for this particular virus. And that was what allowed the Moderna vaccine to be developed so quickly, because the Vaccine Research Center and Barney Graham were partnering with this private company, the Moderna company. So they had a running head start.
And could you tell me more about the contagious cancer in Tasmanian devils you were researching? I've never heard of that before.
Well, this is something that I've been aware of for 20 years. And I've been incubating this book idea for 18 years since I was in Tasmania in 2007. To write about this situation with the Tasmanian devil. Now, the Tasmanian devil is this wonderful little animal. It's a marsupial carnivore. It's a scavenger, occasionally a predator. It looks like this. It also looks like this. That's the kind of a disease nerd Quammen is. He has a plush toy of the Tasmanian devil, because the Tasmanian devil, poor creature, has been devastated by an epidemic of genuinely contagious cancer. And I do not mean a contagious virus that triggers cancer. I mean a genuinely contagious tumor. It's a facial tumor, so it gets into the mouth, into the jaws, into the face of these poor animals, because they bite one another in the face when they're competing for mates and during mating interactions, and they cause wounds, and the tumor is a crumbly tumor, and it crumbles off the tumor in one devil and it falls into the wounds. I can't believe I'm doing all this with a plush toy. This is the beginning, I suppose, of my book tour, but the book won't come out until next year. Maybe I shouldn't say too much about this, but yeah, that people, I hope, will be aware that there will be a book on this whole subject of cancer as evolution, including how is it possible for a tumor to evolve to be contagious, to pass from one individual to another. It is possible. It is because tumors evolve. Tumors in humans also evolve. They evolve to become resistant to chemotherapies, which is why one chemotherapy is used for 6 months or so on a cancer, and then it doesn't work anymore. And so they say that the cancer has progressed and we need a different chemo. Anyway, all of this is tangled together in a book that I have just finished writing for Simon & Schuster in the U.S. My working title is Speak of the Devil. And it's about cancer as an evolutionary phenomenon.
Sounds fascinating.
Including but not limited to this extreme event in the Tasmanian devil.
Is that
but also
first,
including the implications for treatment of human cancers.
Is that the first ever case of there being a genuinely contagious cancer ever?
No, it isn't.
Really?
And to learn more about that, you'll have to wait for my book.
Yeah, we'll have to do another episode once it's come out.
I would be delighted to, Jacob. Yeah, I'd be delighted. Put it. Let's put a mental bookmark in that idea.
Yeah, we definitely will. I'll definitely read it as well. Where do you think the next pandemic will come from? You said it can be by chance when you were speaking about your kind of beer truck analogy. It can go either way. It can hit a pebble. But where do you think it's likely, where it's going to come from and what will it be?
Well, as I said, it's highly unpredictable. So all we can say is, you know, there are chances that this or that will be the next pandemic virus. And of course, everybody has heard about bird flu. Mm-hmm. High pathogenicity avian influenza, H5 avian influenza. Right now, that's the beer truck. That's the beer truck that's sitting on the top of the hill. And it's actually not sitting on the top of the hill. It's rolling down the hill right now, avian influenza. And so it's a matter of which little rocks on that road it hits as to whether it goes off into the grassy field and has no impact or goes into the playground filled with children. Because it'll take, as scientists have said, it'll take a few mutations to turn that bird flu, which has already shown that it can adapt to being also a mammal flu.
Yeah.
It's killed thousands of sea lions, and it has infected dairy cows all over the U.S., and it has gotten into poultry farms and caused millions of chickens to be culled. So it is getting all these chances to evolve. So say one strain, one lineage of the virus needs 4 or 5 mutations. And well, that's highly improbable for it to accumulate those 4 or 5 mutations. But it's highly improbable that you'll win at roulette. Here's another analogy that I've used. The chances that you'll win if you bet on black 13 in a gambling establishment playing roulette, the chances are that you'll lose if you bet on black 13. You can put all your money on black 13, you'll probably lose. If you bet it again, you'll probably lose again. But if you bet black 13 a million times, eventually you're going to win one of those times. And the roulette wheel is spinning millions of times every minute on this virus.
Scary.
Because it exists in such quantity in so many different individual animals, birds and mammals around the world, and it's replicating in cells of those creatures. So the roulette wheel is spinning, it's probably spinning trillions of times per minute.
Mm. And do you know any mutations that would have to occur for it to become more transmissible in humans, or for it to become a full-scale pandemic? Have scientists kind of figured out any?
Yeah, and that's a good question. Scientists have noted a number of kinds of mutations that it would need, and I've written about that again in op-eds for the New York Times. The one that's easiest to explain and easiest for me to remember, because my head has been completely absorbed in the contagious, in the evolution of cancer in recent months, but the one that's worth highlighting is there's a particular kind of cell receptor. Viruses, of course, are not cells. They're parasites of cells. They can only replicate themselves inside the cells of a cellular creature, meaning an animal, a plant, or a bacteria. And to get into the cells to replicate, they need to latch on to particular hooks, particular configurations on the outside of the cell. So, you could think of it as Velcro, or you could think of it as sort of a hook or eye arrangement. The virus has to have the right kind of hook to connect with the right kind of eye on the cell. When it can do that, it can enter the cell. And those cell receptors for avian influenza are primarily found in the gastrointestinal systems of birds, because influenzas begin with wild aquatic birds. And alpha 2, 3 receptors, alpha 2, 3 or 2, 4 sialic acid is the technical term. And those receptors are found on the outsides of cells in the gastrointestinal tracts of birds. If the virus mutated so that it could use not the alpha 2, 4 or 3, correct me if I'm wrong on one, which that is, but instead could use the alpha 2, 6, a slightly different kind of receptor. The airways of mammals are filled with cells with those sorts of receptors. So if it adapted to that cell receptor, it would become easily transmissible to mammals, including humans, and from mammal to mammal. So that particular mutation shifting to an alpha 2, 6 receptor could make this virus much more transmissible to humans and among humans.
And what are the likely symptoms of avian influenza if it got able to be transmitted into humans? What would be some symptoms that are likely to occur, and why would it be dangerous?
The symptoms would be respiratory. The symptoms, people would be coughing and sneezing and passing this virus that way. Right now, you hear about occasional human cases, like, there's a poultry worker somewhere, there's a dairy worker somewhere, and that person experiences a particular kind of symptom. I just fact-checked myself quickly. It is in birds. It's the alpha 2-3 sialic acid receptors. You don't need to remember. Nobody needs to remember sialic acid, but just alpha 2-3 receptors allow avian influenza to enter the cells of birds, and it's alpha 2-6 receptors that represent the attachment point for human influenza viruses. So just here, let me get back here. There we go. Just shifting from alpha 2-3 to alpha 2-6 could make this transmissible among humans.
Have there been any cases of it being in humans yet or not then?
Yes, a few cases. And as I was saying before we got cut off, there have been a few human cases. Since 1997, this virus first emerged in 1997. Yeah. And so there were a few human cases, and it was highly lethal. There was something like a 40 or 50% mortality rate in human cases. And then the virus, this whole complex of H5 viruses, but particularly the dominant strain, evolved a bit. And more recently, it has gotten into fewer humans. That's good news. And when it has gotten into humans, it hasn't been as lethal. That's also good news, but that good news could reverse itself to bad news very, very quickly. And the recent cases among humans, if I recall correctly, have been detected in poultry workers, in dairy workers, because of not because of respiratory symptoms, but because of conjunctivitis. What's conjunctivitis? Pink eye. You know, inflamed eyes. And why has it been inflamed eyes? If I recall correctly, it's because our eyes contain cells with alpha-2-3 receptors.
Wow. Wow.
Now, again, fact check me on that, because I've been in a different world and my memory is not perfect. But I think that's what it has been. And it's also been circulating in dairy cows. Why is it circulating so effectively in dairy cows? Well, it's thought that it's circulating through the milk and perhaps through the milking machines. And if a milking machine is attached to one cow's udders and then insufficiently cleaned and attached to another cow's udders, the infection could be passed from one cow to another. And then somebody writes a paper and says, well, here's an interesting point. The udders of cows, of dairy cows, contain high concentrations of alpha-2-3 receptors. So this virus in its bird form is highly capable of infecting and lurking in the udders of dairy cows. And if you had just one cow in a field in Norway and one young woman or young man who was charged with milking that cow, the infection wouldn't be passing. But when you've got 1,000 dairy cows in a barn with automatic milking machines being moved from one to the other and perhaps not being sufficiently cleaned in between, then this virus finds a very, very welcoming environment for transmission among those animals.
And that leads me to the next question, which is, how does human activity increase the chances of a global pandemic?
Well, that's again a very important question. And the answer is a couple of things. First of all, the harvest of the capture and transport and sale of wild animals for food at a commercial level through markets is very, very dangerous activity. So that's one of the things we humans do that invites these viruses that live in wild animals to become human viruses, whether it's rodents or bats or civets or whatever. All wild animals carry viruses. Some of those viruses are potentially capable of taking hold in humans, adapting quickly, becoming human viruses. And by capturing, transporting, selling, butchering, eating wild animals, we invite those viruses to become human viruses. That's one thing we're doing. And I say we. Not everybody is buying wild animals from live markets, but it's being done. It's being done in places where there's high biological diversity and hungry people. And people need protein to feed themselves, to feed their children. If they have nothing else, they rely on the forest. They rely on wild animals. They jeopardize their health and the health of others by doing that. The other thing that we're doing, and most of us are involved, are implicated directly in this. The other thing is industrial scale animal husbandry. Massive pig farms, massive cattle operations, massive poultry operations with millions of chickens living under one roof. Those two are aspects of dangerous activity that invite new viruses to pass from wild animals to domestic animals and then from domestic animals into humans. And in the domestic animals, if you've got a million chickens under one roof, the virus is passing among them. Again, the roulette wheel is spinning and spinning and spinning. And you're giving that virus trillions of opportunities to acquire the mutations, the adaptations to become a human virus.
Yeah, and it, like you said, it increases the chances of a spillover event. And for those who don't know what a spillover event is, could you describe that and define that for me?
Yes. That's sort of the beginning point of this conversation. Spillover. Spillover is the moment when an infectious agent, a virus, a bacterium, some other kind of infectious creature, passes from its non-human host into its human host. The term for this whole group of phenomena, viruses and other infectious agents spilling over from non-human animals to humans, is zoonoses. Animal infections that become human infections, zoonotic infections. And the moment of passage from the non-human animal host to the human is what we call spillover. Spilling over into a new host.
Exactly. And I've noticed, well, you mentioned kind of wild animals and wild meat, but also large-scale husbandry and farming. But I noticed for diseases such as HIV and Ebola and Nipah virus in your book, they all seem to originate in quite tropical and maybe less developed countries. What are the reasons for that?
Well, the first reason for that is that those tropical countries with lower income countries, less developed, are amid, contain, or adjacent to areas of high biological diversity, tropical forests. And the more biological diversity you have, the more different kinds of animals and plants and bacteria you have, the more different kinds of animals you have, the more viruses you have, because every kind of animal contains its own unique forms of viruses. And therefore, the higher chance that some of those viruses that have the capacity to become human viruses get the opportunity to become human viruses, because humans come in contact with those animals. And then the other reason for low-income countries being the origins of some of these viruses, perhaps more than their share, but not necessarily much more than their share, we can talk about that, is because in lower-income countries, people were more likely to be eating wildlife for protein.
For example, bushmeat. Transmitting the Ebola virus.
Right. Well, what we call bushmeat. I say this in my book. Bushmeat is a term that has this sort of a negative onus on it. I live in Montana. I'm in Montana in the U.S. right now. People love to hunt. People kill deer and elk and moose and ducks for food. We call it game when people in developed countries do it. And when people in low-income countries do it, we call it bushmeat.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the same thing though, isn't it? Like fundamentally.
It is the same thing. Yep.
And I remember when I first tried to read your book when I was 10, that was kind of when Ebola was prominent, especially in the media.
Yeah.
Why?
God bless you. Thank you for reading or trying to read my book at 10, Jacob.
I tried to read it, yeah. I mean, that's how long I've been interested in zoonoses and diseases, and your book definitely helped me become more interested in it. So thank you for that. But why was Ebola so prevalent in the media? Why was it such a scare? I mean, I know the symptoms are bad, but for those who don't remember what the symptoms were like and how much of a big deal this was, could you just go into a bit more background on how
your experiences
in the field as well?
Yeah. Well, Ebola has high shock value. Ebola is dramatic. And Ebola has been sensationalized by some of my colleagues in journalism and book publication. I'm not going to name any names, but Ebola Ebola is a very, very deadly virus, a very serious virus, and it causes horrible illness in people. But it has a reputation of being this extraordinarily bloody virus, causing people's bodies to hemorrhage, to exude blood, blood coming from the eyes, blood coming, you know, in the stool, blood everywhere. And occasionally, Ebola virus in a human causes hemorrhage, but that's not the primary symptom. That's not the primary aspect of it, the natural history of it. That has been wildly exaggerated. Generally, Ebola kills by causing organ failure and severe fever. And it causes people to have diarrhea, and it causes people to vomit, and it's carried in bodily fluids, and including blood, but not limited to blood, and not usually blood. So in places, in remote parts of Africa where you've got maybe a little provincial clinic and 20 villages surrounding it at a 30-kilometer distance, and an outbreak of Ebola occurs, maybe that person with Ebola is transported to that clinic. This is a classic case of how the history of Ebola began. And the person is vomiting and the person has diarrhea. And there are nursing nuns who are cleaning up after that person. They're on their hands and knees. They're using rags to clean up. They've got cracks on their hands from washing dishes. They get exposed that way. And so more and more people become infected. In 2014, that occurred back in 1976 in what then was Zaire, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. That was the very first known outbreak of Ebola. More recently, and maybe you remember this, 2014, there was a big outbreak in three West African countries, Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia.
Yeah.
It was the biggest outbreak of Ebola ever by far. Most Ebola outbreaks killed dozens to maybe low hundreds of people, and then they were contained. They were stopped. Generally because it was happening in remote rural villages in Africa, and people weren't getting on airplanes and carrying it around. And they in most cases, they weren't even getting on buses. When it happened in West Africa, it happened in areas where it started in one village, spread to another village, and then people were able to get on buses and bush taxis, and they went to the capital cities. First of all, to the capital city of Guinea, and it started to spread that way, and it spread through those three countries because those three countries had been racked with 20 years of civil war.
Yeah.
Their healthcare systems were devastated. The incomes were low. There were people living together in big slums without sufficient healthcare, without sufficient city services, sewage, et cetera, et cetera. And the virus spread. So instead of infecting 300 people and killing 150, it infected 27,000 people and killed 11,000. Hmm. And it was all over the headlines, all over the world. And people were worrying about, well, is Ebola going to spread around the world? Is it going to be the next pandemic? And disease scientists always knew that that was not likely because Ebola was not a respiratory disease, could not be passed on a sneeze or a cough, as far as we knew and as far as we still know. It could only be passed by bodily fluids. And it was easier to contain than a coronavirus or an influenza virus.
Mm.
And so it was a horrible event for those three West African countries, but it spread almost nowhere else.
And you said it was exchanged through bodily fluids and it didn't end up going around the world, which was what I was going to ask you. So thanks for clarifying that to me. but how come a disease such as HIV seemed to get into more developed and Western countries when aren't they kind of transmitted similarly, both through bodily fluids, or is Ebola not sexually transmitted like HIV is? And is that what stopped becoming widespread?
Scientists think that Ebola can be sexually transmitted.
Oh.
But generally, Ebola makes people so sick so quickly that the last thing they're going to do is have sex. HIV, and I tell the story, as you know, I devote 100 pages in Spillover to the ecological history of HIV and the AIDS pandemic. And it's very complicated, but it's a story that now is pretty well understood. It's very counterintuitive. It began much earlier than people think. Began probably in around the turn of the 20th century in 1908, give or take a margin of error. And it began in the southeastern corner of Cameroon. And the virus came from a chimpanzee and got into a human, probably because the human was hunting, killing, and butchering a chimpanzee and got blood-to-blood contact. That's what's called the cut hunter hypothesis, the hypothesis that some hunter cut himself and got chimpanzee blood into that cut. But HIV, and we're talking about HIV 1 group M, a particular strain of HIV that has caused the entire global pandemic. There are other strains that are in humans but don't transmit nearly as well and are not as lethal. HIV 1 group M is the pandemic strain. It's a very patient virus, kills people slowly. So it has gotten around the world, not by being highly transmissible on a cough, a sneeze, a breath, but by being patient. So, and it's transmitted in bodily fluids, intravenous, needle contact, but most famously sexual transmission. And people who are initially infected with the virus don't know it, and they do have sex. Unlike somebody who has 105 fever and is vomiting from Ebola. So that's the big difference between those two. There are other differences too, but that's if you're going to take one swat at saying why is HIV a pandemic virus around the world and why is Ebola not, that's where you start.
Yeah, and like you said, if one causes almost rapid organ failure, like relatively quickly, then that's going to make it hard for it to pass on compared to one that's, like you said, right. slowly progressively worse. And I heard you say in a podcast about the evolution of viruses, and it's probably the wrong terminology, but do they actually want to kill their hosts? What saying want about a virus is, you know, the touchy terminology, yeah. But do they want to kill their host?
I get what you're asking and how you're asking it. And of course the answer is viruses don't want anything. Viruses are too simple to want. Viruses, as I've said elsewhere too, you know, they can't walk, they can't run, they can't swim, they can't fly. They ride, they tumble, they spill. And the only sense in which they want anything is the Darwinian sense. They do evolve. They are subject to evolution by natural selection, Charles Darwin's wonderful basic mechanism for how biological diversity has appeared on Earth. All these wondrous different forms with their wondrous different adaptations, it's been evolution by natural selection. And viruses also adapt by evolution by natural selection. Any creature that replicates itself with a genome, an RNA or a DNA genome, an information molecule that makes copies of itself, and those copies then are spread in offspring of that creature. And as it makes copies of its genome, it occasionally makes mistakes, makes changes, produces mutations, variations in the genome, and then leaves offspring. Any creature that does that is subject to Darwinian evolution by natural selection. So viruses are guided to their adaptations by that, by evolution by natural selection. And I talk about the three Darwinian imperatives, that any creature that replicates with a genome is subject to these three Darwinian imperatives. First of all, make copies of yourself. Produce offspring, produce babies. Secondly, spread yourself out in geographical space as much as possible. Colonize new territory. And third, extend yourself in time. Avoid extinction. And that's what viruses do. They obey those three Darwinian imperatives. Make babies, spread yourself out in geographical space, and try your best not to go extinct. And the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the COVID-19 virus, has been very successful in doing that without in the least wanting to hurt humans.
Yeah. Yes. Makes more sense when you explain it through evolutionary terms. I've read that, correct me if I'm wrong, 8% of the human genome is kind of been, was it, is it made from or caused by
yes,
viruses?
Your memory is good, and you may have read that in my book, The Tangled Tree. It's a book about the tree of life and how the tree of life is much more complicated than we thought it was, and molecular discoveries, molecular phylogenetics, molecular building of family trees has shown us. And one of the things that this great revolution in molecular genetics, genome sequencing, and the comparing of genomes to build family trees, one of the things that that has revealed is a phenomenon called endogenous retroviruses. Endogenous retroviruses, which just means viruses that move backwards, and they insert their genomes, which are RNA genomes, simple single-strand molecules. They insert, they infect cells of cellular creatures, including us humans. And a virus like that, a retrovirus, infects a human. Now, HIV is a retrovirus, and it targets our immune cells. So it inserts copies of itself into the genome, makes its own RNA genome into DNA, and inserts that into the genome of immune cells. And sometimes it lurks there for a long time, and then eventually it bursts out in many copies of the HIV virus and infects other immune cells. But it can lurk in the genome dormant for a long time. If it inserts itself not into an immune cell, but into a sperm cell or an egg cell, it gets passed along to the next generation of humans in the sperm or the egg cell. And that then is what is called an endogenous retrovirus, a virus that has infected the germline, the our gonads, the cells that make our sperm and egg cells. It has infected those cells so that it's become perpetuated in the human genome and passed along. And it can lurk there forever. It can be disabled so that it's not ever going to break out and make more virus copies of itself. And it can even be co-opted into performing a function, becoming a gene in the human genome.
Wow.
And we now know that this is where your question was targeted. We now know that 8% of the human genome consists of viruses that have inserted themselves into the mammalian lineage over the last 100 million years, 8% of our genome. And some of those virus genes are dormant. They're just sitting there doing nothing as far as we know. And some of them are doing things that are somewhat similar to what they did for viruses, but now are performing a function for humans. And there is one endogenous retrovirus called syncytin number 2, S-Y-N-C-Y-T-I-N, syncytin number 2, that's in our genomes that is responsible for creating the membrane between the fetus and the placenta in a pregnant woman that makes it possible for the woman, the mother, to send nutrients to the fetus and the fetus to send waste products out to the mother so that they can be voided out. Completely necessary for successful human pregnancy. What gene does that? Syncytin number 2 does that. Where does syncytin number 2 come from? It comes from an infection of some mammal with a virus maybe 60 million years ago.
That is absolutely incredible. The fact that they're going to be advantageous as well is mind-boggling.
Yeah. So it's all, it's all evolution. It's all the entanglement of different life forms by the movement of genetic material, in some cases horizontally across species boundaries, as well as vertically from parents to offspring. And that plus good old Darwin.
Mm. Could bacteria and, is it protozoa, could they do similar things, or is it only viruses that can affect our genome?
As far as I know, bacteria and protozoa, or protists as they're now called, like, these single-celled creatures that are parasites but are not bacteria or viruses, as far as I know, they cannot insert themselves into the human genome. I hope you can't hear that. I've got a phone call coming in that I'm just going to ignore.
No, it's fine. Okay. It's fine. Yeah, it's all good.
Folks, we have lots of stuff going on. We've had interruptions, but Jacob and Kwaman are having a great time talking to each other, and Jacob is going to fix it all with editing.
Exactly. Yeah. By endurance, we conquer.
Yeah.
Keep persevering.
Yeah. Anyway, as far as I know, bacteria and protists cannot do that. What bacteria can do is a whole lot of horizontal gene transfer. So different species of bacteria are constantly passing genes sideways from one to another. And that's how the problem of antibiotic resistant bacteria, which is now a very serious problem, killing more than 1 million people a year around the world, that's how that has become such a widespread problem. It's not by the independent evolving of resistance to bacteria, resistance to antibiotics by different species of bacteria, but one species of bacterium can evolve a resistance to a particular antibiotic, and then it can pass the genes for that resistance in an instant, not just to another individual bacterial particle, but to a different species of bacteria through what's called horizontal gene transfer.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That they can, different types can interact. How come the predictions aren't for the next pandemic to be a potentially antibiotic resistant bacteria? How come it's normally a virus that tends to be the likely culprit for another pandemic?
It's because of two things. I think viruses have the potential to spread much more quickly than bacteria do. It's because people aren't aware of how serious the problem of antibiotic-resistant bacteria is. I was aware of the problem when I wrote the book, The Tangled Tree, but I wasn't aware recently of the death toll. I thought it was tens of thousands of people dying per year, but I saw recently in a scientific source that it's in the most recently measured year, which is, I think, 2023, it was almost 1.3 million people around the world died of antibiotic-resistant bacterial infections. So that's sort of a slow-motion, invisible pandemic that's going on.
Hmm. it's almost like an evolutionary arms race between the bacteria and the antibacterial medication.
Because it's absolutely an evolutionary arms race. That's another way of saying Darwinian natural selection.
Yeah, it's scary because, you know, we're probably creating something, a bacteria that was worse than what the original one began, like that we were trying to treat was.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The original antibiotics discovered by humans were forms of molecule that bacteria used for competing against one another. And natural, natural substances such as, the penicillin found in the penicillium mold. So they began with natural substances. We learned how to synthesize them, and we taught ourselves how to manufacture them, and then bacteria taught themselves how to be resistant to them.
For a final few questions, in terms of global warming and ice melting, there's kind of that conspiracy or theory that that could potentially maybe unlock some dormant diseases in the ice. How true is that, and how likely is that to happen, and how much should we be worried about that happening?
You know, of all the things that we should be worrying about, I put that fairly low on the list. Is it possible? Yes, it's possible. It's not imaginary. But why not worry about the millions of viruses in living creatures that are already circulating, running around in our barns in rodents, running around in caves in bats, running around in wild animals that we're capturing to eat, running around in our chickens on poultry farms, running around in our dairy cows. People have a tendency, and so I think we should worry much more about that. And worry is not useful. I think we should be concerned and acting, taking steps on that problem rather than being distracted by the science fiction movie aspects of a dangerous killer virus being thawed out because climate change is melting ice at the poles. Now, it's horribly serious that climate change is melting ice at the poles, and it's causing a whole lot of things that concern me more than the chance of unlocking a virus. For instance, it's pushing polar bears toward extinction, and I hate that. People have a tendency, though, some people have a tendency to believe now that we're very aware of climate change, that climate change is the one big problem that explains everything. And every problem we have, infectious diseases, emerging diseases, whatever, it's a subset of climate change. Message that I've been trying to get across is, no, that is not the case. Climate change is a very, very serious human-caused problem, and it sits parallel to two other human-caused problems: climate change, loss of biological diversity, and the emergence of new diseases. And we humans are doing things to cause all three of those problems. Those problems are like three great, roiling, high, dark, muddy rivers that are connected, interconnected with some channels, but basically they're three rivers, and they're all filled with this roiling brown water because of one cause. We humans are melting a great snowfield on a mountain, and that melting snowfield, this is a metaphorical snowfield now, is feeding those three rivers of trouble. What's melting that snowfield? Human population size multiplied by consumption. 8 billion humans on this planet, very smart, very hungry, very rapacious, very impatient, with very powerful technology, consuming, consuming, consuming. And that's what's melting the snowfield and feeding those three rivers. And there are interconnections. Climate change has some impacts on infectious disease. It's causing Among other things, it's causing mosquitoes that carry dangerous viruses to be expanding their ranges out of the tropics into the temperate zones. That's a problem related to climate change. Was COVID-19 caused by climate change? No. As far as we know, not. Separate. Sometimes separate, sometimes connected.
And would your opinion on the thawing ice, would that also be a similar opinion for you about biowarfare, the potential of using diseases as weaponry? Do you think that's a low concern or not?
That is a concern. It's certainly a concern. Again, it's not at the top of the list of concerns because nature is developing and distributing dangerous new viruses faster than any secret laboratory in Russia or China or the U.S. can do. And viruses are difficult to target. You know, you can cause massive death and chaos with the virus, but you can't confine it to chaos and death for your enemy, your political enemy. It's going to come back and cause, you know, chaos and death to you too. Biochemical weaponry is again a very serious problem, but it's not the first default level concern for us to go to when it comes to dangerous viruses. The first default level concern is the things that we're doing to cause already existing viruses to become human viruses.
And in terms of overpopulation and overconsumption, do you think in the distant and near future, maybe colonizing planets such as Mars is a adequate solution? Or do you think we should just be focusing solely on fixing our problems on Earth and forgetting about trying to colonize other planets?
Well, yes. I do think we should concern ourselves with fixing our problems on Earth. I mean, colonizing Mars and going out through the solar system and exploring, it's an interesting and noble ambition. And I think it's important for humans to have noble ambitions. But it has no importance and no value for saving the things that need saving on planet Earth right now. It's very costly, so it takes away from our efforts to save things on planet Earth. And therefore I don't think it should be a priority.
Do you think in the long term, if the costs were greatly reduced and a lot of people could move there safely, do you think that would put less strain on Earth's resources if we were able to kind of in the long term terraform Mars and you kind of start from there and start a new colonization?
I don't think that that's a valuable way to think about colonizing Mars at all. I don't think it's going to solve any of our problems of crowding or resource use. It's going to take resources to put people on Mars and to keep people on Mars. And those resources, you know, maybe the moon or Mars could be mined for minerals. It's going to take resources from planet Earth to support those efforts for the foreseeable hundreds of years. And those resources are going to further exacerbate the problems that I was talking about, the three great rivers of trouble.
And what can governments and countries do to solve or try and mitigate those three troubles? What do you think they can do?
Well, right now, the thing that I think is most important for governments to do, and what I really mean is for people to do with their governments, assuming they have some democratic control of those governments, is to stop this ridiculous rejection of science and support for science and turn back to science and real science, peer-reviewed, professional, highly educated science conducted by genuinely curious and well-trained men and women, and stop this this idiocy of denying science, rejecting science, taking funding away from science. And you know, obviously that's a problem in my country now more than anywhere else, but it's not just my country. So we need to, and how do we do that? Well, I think part of it is we have a desperate need to do a better job of educating children in what science is, how it operates, and why it's valuable and important.
And adding to that, in terms of education, what one to three books have greatly influenced your life and your career that you'd recommend to a younger person who wants to be educated?
I've tried to produce some books of that sort myself, and I have been influenced by books. I've been influenced by the books of Edward O. Wilson, the great Edward O. Wilson, books on biological diversity, the diversity of life, his book Naturalist, which is his intellectual autobiography, his book Biophilia, which is a fancy word for love of life. So maybe biophilia. If I were talking to the 10-year-old Jacob, and he were asking me, what should I read besides this crazy thing from somebody named Quammen called Spillover, I would say, try Biophilia.
Yeah.
By Edward O. Wilson. Maybe some books by Carl Zimmer. Some books by Betsy Elizabeth Colbert. Some books by Ed Yong. Some books by Richard Dawkins.
I'm reading Selfish Gene actually at the moment.
There you go. Okay. All right. Richard is a brilliant guy. And that's a fascinating book. And it'll teach you a lot about evolution. And some books by this wonderful, gentle, charming Englishman who died in 1882 named Charles Darwin. You could read his Journey of the Voyage of the Beagle, The Voyage of the Beagle by Charles Darwin. That's another one I would recommend to the 10-year-old Jacob.
Well, the 20-year-old Jacob will add it to his reading list to make up for the decade loss. final question. If you had one piece of advice for your 20-year-old self, what would it be?
My 20-year-old self was trying to be a novelist. He knew that he wanted to be a writer, but he didn't know which kind of writer. And at the age of 20, I had written my first novel, and it was published when I was 22. And I thought, okay, now I get to be a novelist. You know, this was 50 years ago. I would have told my 20-year-old self, start reading Charles Darwin 5 years earlier than you did. Start reading nonfiction. Start reading Stephen Jay Gould. Start reading Lauren Isley. Start reading J.B.S. Haldane. Start reading Mary Kingsley. Read nonfiction about the natural world, because that's what you're going to end up spending your life writing.
Brilliant. David Quammen, ladies and gentlemen. David, I absolutely love you and your work. And I cannot believe if I told 10-year-old self that I'd be interviewing you 9 years later or a decade later, he would have been absolutely blown away. So thank you so much for sharing your time with me.
Jacob,
today.
It's my very great pleasure to have a conversation with you.
Brilliant. And what current things are you working on?
You know what? It's less than a week since I delivered this book on cancer as evolution. It has just gone to my editor at Simon & Schuster. It's just gone to my agent. I have been thinking about that book for 18 years. I have been writing it off and on since 2019. I got interrupted by COVID and wrote a book about the book I showed you, Breathless, but then I got back to it. And I'm exhausted. So I'm hoping to spend the summer sitting in the backyard, recharging my batteries. Right now I'm reading a book about the Roman Republic by Mary Beard, the great Cambridge historian. The book, SPQR by Mary Beard. Senate Populusque Romanus. the Senate and people of Rome, SPQR, the great slogan of the Roman Republic. So I'm reading your Mary Beard, great Cambridge historian, sitting in an Adirondack chair in the backyard, recharging my batteries. That's what I'm working on right now.
Brilliant. Sounds awesome. And where can people go if they want to find your work?
Online, any bookstore. My website is simply my name, you know, www.davidquammen. And my books are available in Britain and the US and Italy and elsewhere. And in Tasmania, thank goodness. Tasmania is one of my favorite places in the world.
Brilliant. And I'll leave the links to all of your work in the show notes. And yeah, thank you for joining me and see you soon for hopefully round two on the Tasmanian Devil.
Sounds good. Cheers, Jacob.
Brilliant.
Nice to talk with you.
Bye-bye. You too. Bye.